want to commit to social media agency just yet? Why not try a content day? We will create 10 custom curated done-for-you reels for your brand. Before the content day, we will provide a comprehensive plan of what will be creative. We will provide all the props, etc. that you need. Contact Jack Digital today for more details.
Welcome to the Self Belief Podcast, where we talk with people who have great influence in the Metro Detroit business community. We discuss all aspects of their journey, including the moments when they have had to draw deeply on their self-belief to achieve their vision. I will be your host, Keith Baldwin, with my co-host, Jordana Chaffetz, sponsored by Regal Payments and JAC Digital, as well as our studio partner, Office Evolution of Troy. These conversations will potentially make you re-examine your beliefs about business, people, and life in general. Here's a taste of what's coming up today.
So if we do our job well as educators, we will constantly be creating forums, both in and out of the classroom, on the playing field, the stage, in the art studio, wherever it might be, where kids can explore, they can wonder, they can create, and they can encounter the uncomfortable and wrestle through that. They can be presented with ideas that are completely foreign to them. Hopefully discuss those with their peers, with their families. Yeah. But if we can all do it in a way that says we're all here together, that seems like a pretty worthwhile undertaking.
Let's explore and scrutinize together as we unlock the mind of today's guests to provide you with inspiration and tangible takeaways that you can choose to apply in your life. Today, we're taking you back to school with Tom Shepherd, who is a principal at Leggett School. And Tom has worked at schools in Pebble Beach in California. He's been out in New Jersey, Ridgeland, Mississippi, and back out to Palos Verdes in California before taking over at Leggett in July of 2023. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Hey, we're really excited to have you. We've been considering wanting to do an education episode for a while, and we're very happy that you accepted our invite. And especially being new to the area as well, how are you like in Michigan? I mean, you know, you lived in Pebble Beach, so you've only gone up, right, to Michigan?
That's right. You know, I really have had the good fortune of living in a variety of different communities, and it only reinforces the most important piece, that no matter where you go, it's the people that matter.
Right. Yeah. How well? I mean, I lived in Memphis and I ran soccer camps in the southern states, so I know I've been through a lot of Mississippi. But that was 20 plus years ago. How did you enjoy Mississippi? Where's Ridgeland? Was it near Jackson?
Yeah, Ridgeland's a suburb, the first suburb north of Jackson. Uh-huh. And I absolutely loved everything about living in Mississippi, and not just the Deep South, but specifically Mississippi, because there are so many stories to be told there.
Oh,
and
that's very cool.
The culture is rich, and the learning opportunities. And it's not all a pretty history, but it's amazing. And then for me, one of the most fascinating pieces was, as a head of a school, I got to begin the pandemic in Mississippi, and all of that and what goes on there, and then transition in the middle of the pandemic to a school in Los Angeles, California. So
what
two
a difference.
Totally different communities, each struggling and doing their best and working within the confines of culture and politics and medicine. But I think that was one of the greatest learning experiences I ever had.
Yeah. What made that move happen? Was it the pandemic, or why move from Mississippi?
It was great. It was in Mississippi, and an opportunity arose in California as a two-year terminal assignment to help an amazing school really find its footing and get through the pandemic and maybe, you know, calm the waters, as it was a pretty turbulent time for all of us. And it was the two most rewarding years of my life ever. So lifelong friends we made in the 2 years there and still keep in touch with them.
Amazing.
And then to follow that up with the opportunity to come here to Michigan, even better. Lucky me.
Yeah. What was some of the issues you needed to go fix down at that school?
Well, not surprising and probably common to a lot of our experiences, both in schools and in all parts of society. Right? We have a variety of views on how medicine and science and policies should all unfold during the pandemic, all well-intentioned and strongly held views. And maybe we got to find common ground. We got to learn to work together. And of course, in my case, you're also throwing the variable of it's not just healthcare you're talking about, but you're talking about children.
True. Right.
And that requires a lot of listening and compromise and thoughtful reflection, but also accepting the reality that some things are not problems, they're dilemmas. So they shouldn't be solved, they need to just be managed. And I think a lot of that in the pandemic was true in education. We just managed the dilemmas in front of us to the best of our ability.
Yeah. Yeah, now you're obviously a teacher with quite a bit of experience. And one thing I've always kind of disliked is the stereotype of a generation as they get older, kind of looking, not with dismay, but looking down on the next generation, or they don't do this quite as well as us, or, you know, oh, this generation's lazy. And, you know, I'm taking it to the extreme. But I would imagine as a teacher, you have a bit more optimism about the youth. What do you like about today's youth, and what are they doing better than us?
Oh, you know, I tell people all the time I have the best job in the world. I get to spend my days with 600 kids.
Right.
Ranging from 3-year-olds to 18-year-olds, and they just bring you great joy. But they also leave you optimistic about the future.
Hmm.
In many ways. For example, you know, my students every day without even knowing that they're doing it, are teaching me about different things to prioritize, different ways of doing things. They are absolutely pulling me forward with them into the future when it comes to technology.
Right.
You know, I'm a digital immigrant. They are digital natives.
Sure.
And so it never ends. So it's a great contrast. I'm supposed to be teaching them, but in reality, much of my day is spent learning from the students.
I love that.
That's a great paradox.
Yeah. What's some of the best lessons they teach you?
They keep you humble. Yeah, they keep you on your toes. One of the things I love about working at a pre-K to 12th grade school on one campus is there is no greater joy that an educator will experience than a bear hug around the knees from a 4-year-old.
Mm.
At the same time, while those kids are teaching me unqualified kindness and love, my 18-year-olds are teaching me that every day you've got to be your best self, you've got to be transparent, and you've got to be honest, because no 18-year-old is going to let you in until they size you up and figure out you're not a phony.
Right. And, teaching has many, many challenges. And what in that first year of teaching, you know, what were some mistakes you made maybe in relating to an 18-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 4-year-old, and things you've got better at with experience over the years? But any things you remember from your first year of teaching?
I remember a lot. I remember it was the hardest thing I ever did.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, one of my more senior colleagues in my department, I was a history teacher. I'll never forget this image. He was smoking his corncob pipe and pulled it out of his mouth and said to me, "You know, Tom, surviving the first year is succeeding." And I thought, well, that's crazy. You know, what does that mean? Well, by December, I knew exactly what he was talking about. I perceive myself as the worst teacher in the world. They're just trying to figure this out one day at a time. And you're not just teaching. In my case, I was coaching. I was running a dormitory because of the boarding school. I was an advisor. And then magically, in your second year, at least in my second year, a lot of those challenges disappear, and you transition in a classroom setting from worrying about your own survival to realizing you're supposed to be focused on the kids and their education.
Right.
And when you reach that turning point, it becomes a much more manageable task.
So what were some practical things you did different when you shifted your focus?
A couple of things. Entering into a great graduate school program made sure that I was continually learning. So that helped me always to think about the future. Second was, like any 21-year-old, I was still maturing. I was still growing. This is my first...
You were still young, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was a college kid, and then all of a sudden I'm supposed to be a professional. I say, whoa. But lucky me, and I'm sure this is true for many people, I looked around and I realized I was surrounded by amazing potential mentors. And even more amazing was the fact that without me even asking, they took me under their wing and said, hey, let's show you a few things here that might help.
That's great.
And they did.
Right. Now I'm going to take you back. Talking of mentors, your parents, but both, not just your parents, but they were teachers.
Yep.
And you grew up in the big island of Hawaii.
Yep.
And tell me about that. When did you, how long did you stay in Hawaii? And did you have an early inkling that you wanted to be a teacher or a coach, something like that?
Yeah. Yeah, I was born and raised in Hawaii, born in 1970, and my parents had moved there in 58, actually from Queens, New York.
Wow.
When it was still a territory, wasn't even a state, and their family thought they were crazy, jumping off the face of the earth. But away they went to a boarding school in Hawaii, and I didn't know any different. You know, I was raised in rural Hawaii. It was, you know, walk around without shoes. It was a pretty casual place. And the most important thing, though, was I was constantly surrounded by teenagers, adults, my siblings, who showered me with love. And that feeling of what it meant to be in an educational environment, I think that always stayed with me, because then when I graduated from college, I never even thought about doing anything else except going into education, because right. It was all I knew.
Now, your parents, did they stay in Hawaii for a long time? Did you spend your whole childhood there?
Yep, we stayed there until I was about 10. Then my father became the head of another school, Berkeley Preparatory School in Tampa.
Okay.
And then my high school years were actually in Annapolis, Maryland, at Severn School, my alma mater, which I'm always proud of.
Yeah. How was that moving around? Did you have a favorite place, or you just liked living in all three states there?
You know, there is some research out there that says children are best suited if they have their childhood in one location. Now, I don't know the degree to which that is true or not. I know for myself, I felt that having my childhood in three different locations presented me with opportunities for growth and how to learn to be new, how to learn to acclimate, how to experience different cultures. And that spirit of experiencing the new, the different, has always stayed with me, especially in most of my career was in the world of enrollment, specifically boarding school enrollment. So I would travel the world and travel the country recruiting students. I was always in different locations. Yeah. Loved it.
Now, I know, unless I'm missing some of them here, you were at Stevenson School, Pebble Beach, Lawrence School, New Jersey, you were in Ridgeland, Mississippi, and then Chadwick School in California, and now Liggett. Are they all private high-end boarding schools?
The thing they have in common is that they are private day schools and boarding schools.
Uh-huh.
Some, like Lawrenceville, New Jersey, is 9 through 12, mostly boarding kids from all over the country, all over the world. But on the opposite side of that, St. Andrews in Mississippi is two campuses, 1,100 students, pre-K to 12 day. So we've seen it all, and they all have something to offer.
Was that a deliberate choice by you to go into the private education sector rather than public?
I think it was really a matter of, being 21 and saying what's comfortable and what's familiar to me. At the same time, going into graduate school helped me spend a lot of time with my colleagues in public schools and realize that no matter what setting we teach or are administrators in, we share a lot of things in common and can learn from each other.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think are some of the main differences, and have those differences changed over the years between public and private?
Well, the main difference is that in our case, as an independent school, we are by and large allowed to set our own policies, our own requirements for graduation, what we teach, how we teach it. And we do have a board that governs at a strategic level, but at an operational level, we can define who the school is. And we do that first and foremost on our mission statement. My colleagues in the public schools have a variety of challenges. They have a variety of things that we share in common. But the difference is perhaps the degree to which the government is or isn't involved in the educational process.
Right. And, I know we often can see, issues with government and education. But ultimately, the government should be set up to help educate people better.
Sure.
What are some pros and cons of the government's involvement in public schools, I say?
Well, it's interesting. As we've progressed through the pandemic and a parallel period of significant cultural tension, schools have once again, both private and public schools, have become in many ways the epicenter of some significant cultural issues. And so the challenges we face today are actually very similar, even though our structures are very different. I think, I speak for myself, but many educators, we just want to teach. We want to teach kids. Right. We want to find a way to make sure that we're not distracted by a whole variety of cultural inputs. That's just the way it is. Outside of that, we face a similar challenge in that even though our financial structures are different, the reality of it is providing high-quality education comes at an extraordinary cost.
Yeah.
And so whether you are paying tuition, as is true in the private schools, or relying on tax dollars, as is the case in the public schools, the fact of the matter is we have to do the best we can with the resources we have, and they're never enough.
Hmm.
So it all comes down to a matter of how do we create the best product and the best outcome given what we have in front of us.
Yeah. And what do you feel about the rise in homeschooling over the past 10 years? I mean, I'm talking about pre-pandemic. I know pandemic made some people take that leap. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was a general rise in homeschooling. Mm-hmm. Do you think overall people get the same quality of education? I mean, I'm sure, you know, there's some people that do a very good job at homeschooling. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's the majority, or is it something you like?
It's a great question. I am all in favor of anything that will spur innovation in education. I had hoped, and I am still hopeful, it's a long way, that the pandemic would be the greatest accelerator ever in the world of education.
Mm.
Because it forced us, as painful as some of them may have been, into new ways of thinking, new ways of doing, considering new financial structures. And so whether it's homeschooling, whether it's high-quality virtual learning, whether they are micro-schools, whether they are schools like mine that have a pretty traditional model thinking about how they can do things differently, or in the case of the public schools, thinking how their structures might be different, we can't let these opportunities pass us up. And so at the end of the day, whether somebody is in a homeschool or whether they are in a charter school, public school, private school, I'm all in favor of all of us finding new pathways, and instead of just saying, this is the way education is, because those structures have been in place for a long time and probably need to be evaluated in a very real way.
Yeah. Now, do you have children yourself?
I do. I'm really lucky. I have two wonderful kids. I love talking about them just like anybody else. They both decided after their eighth grade year that, you know, being the student at a school where dad was the head of school might not be the greatest thing for whatever that's worth. And so they decided they wanted to go to boarding school, which they did. And now they're both off in college.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Which state did they do boarding school in?
They both went to an amazing school that's been in my wife's family for multiple generations called St. Andrews in Delaware.
Okay.
Small school, 300 students, most widely known, strangely enough, as the campus where the famous Robin Williams movie Dead Poets Society was filmed.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so that was home, and it's just a magical place.
That's cool. That's one of my favorite movies from when I was younger.
Do you feel like kids get more out of education when they go to boarding school?
I think it's different for everybody. I really do. And what's right for one child is not right for another. I have this conversation all the time because, you know, people might say to me, for example, hey, Tom, your kids don't go to the school where you're the head of the school. What does that say about your belief in the school? I think everybody's education is a personal mm-hmm. choice. And the reason my kids chose to go to an amazing boarding school with very talented kids worked for them. But other kids say, you know what? In our family structure or our family choices, it's better for us to be together. So I can see pros and cons all over the place.
Yeah. But what age did they go to boarding school?
They were 14.
14?
Yep, ninth grade.
Yeah. How was that for you as a parent? Did you adjust to being semi-empty nesters pretty quickly, or was it tough?
Well, for better or for worse, I claim no expertise in parenting. I've never written a parenting book. I've had many failures. But one of the fundamental pieces that my wife and I generally agreed upon was that from the time they were born until the time they finished eighth grade, 13, 14 years old, we were going to pour our heart and soul into them. And then at the age of 14, while we still love our kids and we talk to them all the time, it was probably time for somebody else to be reinforcing all those lessons. And so our philosophy was do everything we can until they're 14 and then give them an opportunity if they want it, and only if they want it.
Right. So you knew from an early age that at 14 they were probably going to go to boarding school?
It was always in the realm of possibilities. And if they'd said, no, we don't want to do that, that was certainly fine too. We've always just said, we want to structure our lives in a way that never prevents our children from pursuing any educational opportunity they might want.
Right. And they're both at different colleges now?
Yeah, my son's at Davidson College in North Carolina, just an amazing,
that's
lovely place.
Steph Curry's alma mater,
Steph Curry's
right?
alma mater, absolutely. Yeah. And as I tell my son all the time, because I've actually met Steph Curry, I say, you know, it's great. Everybody knows Steph Curry is, you know, one of the greatest basketball players of all time. If they do a little more research, what they'll equally become amazed by is that he is a first-rate human being in every way. The stories are legendary.
Right.
So, and then my daughter goes to Colgate in upstate New York as a freshman and having a great time there.
Nice. So talking about college, you're kind of, they're in college now. Yeah. My daughter's 17 this month and going through that selection process and everything to do with that, so is kind of a crazy time. Yeah. How do you feel the college admission process is these days compared to a few years ago? I know it can cause a lot of stress with students and a lot of, you know, it can be overwhelming as well, the choice and where to narrow your focus.
Yeah, it absolutely can be. And that's why I say in any way, shape, or form one might be able to obtain it, getting solid objective advice is helpful, whether that be from a school's college counselor or there are professionals known as educational consultants who help kids find colleges. And then there are things that any family can do to just make the process more manageable for everybody. You know, I'm often quoted as saying, there is no one dream school.
Mm. Right.
You know, keep your options open. And I also know this to be true, that there's a survey done every year of freshmen in college, 3 weeks into their freshman year. And the question is very simple. It says, are you enrolled at your first choice university?
Interesting.
So, no matter, some of them, you know, may have had a first choice university when they were applying, but were they ever they ended up? 90% of the students respond, yes, I'm at my first choice university.
That's great.
So it just works out.
Huh. Well, staying on that theme of stress and, you know, mental health is talked more and more in society and schools. How's that changed with schools' focus on mental health over the years? I know you've only been at Liggett for 10 months, but is that a large part of your scope and role, is making sure all the students have access to counselors and mental health when they need it?
Yeah, it's amazing the things that schools are being asked to take on today that 25 years ago just wasn't the case. And all of these things require resources. So emotional health, mental wellness. When I was a kid in schools, we weren't talking about that too much in the 80s. It just wasn't. And now it absolutely is a big part of education, because those qualities, those skills one might develop, they are at least 50% of what allows one to enjoy success as an adult, whether it be your well-being and your profession. The challenge for us is the pandemic really did a number on kids. There's no denying it. And we are going to be working our way out of that for a long time. Now, fortunately, one of the things I know to be true is that kids are extraordinarily resilient. In a really crass way, sometimes I say to somebody who's having a tough parenting moment, I say, don't worry about it. It's pretty hard to screw them up. They really are tough. And so they will bounce back from this. But we in schools, regardless of the pandemic, we need to ensure that our programming helps kids to understand what they're feeling, to make the most of their skills that they have. And we're doing a pretty good job of it, but it's not easy, because the things they're facing are much harder than when I was a kid. Life was simple when I was a kid.
You mean social media or other things that they're facing?
Absolutely. You give a 14-year-old boy a phone, a 14-year-old girl, but it doesn't matter. There's a lot of potential there, a lot of potential for good, a lot of potential for bad. And we see it all, and, you know, we deal with it. It's also creating worlds that aren't real, things they might feel they have to keep up with, social experiences that I certainly never had when I was a kid. So we're not perfect at it, but the great thing I know about this is at University of Liggett School, we're going through a strategic planning process right now. And our community has already identified this as one of the things that they absolutely want us to focus on. So through that feedback, we know how we're going to harness our energy in the years ahead to keep working for the kids.
Hey, Jordana has a company that does social media for businesses.
I do. And, Jack, you know, Digital.
Yes. So I know that's for businesses and not for kids. But what's your view on, and is it something you have to keep up in education on, how social media affects kids?
I think social media can be good and bad, as you said. I think that social media can be good if you're a business, if you're looking to grow your audience. I think that's wonderful. But I also think that Having a 14-year-old or a 13-year-old on TikTok by themselves without parental control is a terrible idea. Personally, I don't have any children, but like, just like, there's so much, even when I'm on TikTok or I'm on Instagram, there's so much that you could be just like taking down a rabbit hole. Social media is also not real life. So these kids could be like, oh, I could do that, but that's not really the truth. So it's like, I definitely think there should be like a more of a censored on social media for like kids under a certain age.
Do you have a rule on phones in school?
Ah, that's interesting. So we are constantly considering and revising rising our policies. We allow kids to use their phones in academic settings. Now, of course, the challenge is once you do that, kids are tempted by their phones. And so as you go throughout the school day, you're inevitably going to have situations where somebody's not using a phone in the way they should. And that becomes a learning opportunity. On the other hand, I've seen situations at my children's school, for example, they had a complete ban on cell phones, period. It never left your room. There are all ways to approach it. And I don't think any one way is perfect. I think schools have to figure out what works best for them. But it is something that schools and parents are going to be better at if we're aligned and understand and can support each other in that regard.
It's interesting. So actually, I'm going to tell you a story I heard the other day, and I'm so curious on your take. So this influencer I follow, she's in, I think, Dallas. But, like, so she has, like, I think she's 3. And she was, like, basically all your allowance money, you can get whatever you want. So the little 3-year-old, she wanted a phone. So she got her this phone. It was not, like, it was just, like, a play phone. But it, like, lit up. Like, it looked like an actual iPhone. It was not. But so basically, the little girl, she would play with it so much, and I guess she was acting out at school, and she'd come home, and she'd be like, I need that phone, I need it, and like, it was kind of an addiction, so the parents were like, yeah, we're taking this away from her. But you find that kids are like that now, like, if they start so young with technology and everything, and like, there's no, they can have it whenever they want, like, do you see a difference of that in schools these days?
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting observation, and I don't have any of the science to
of
say
course.
Whether or not age has an influence on when they start and how it affects them.
It's an early addiction, though.
It is. You're right. And we see it affecting different kids in very different ways, many of them not great. You know, sleep being we're always encouraged to help students get more sleep. Well, usually the thing that's preventing them from sleeping is being distracted by social media, the phone, while they're doing their homework or when they should be sleeping.
Yeah, go to bed, check your phone.
Yeah.
That sort of thing, and then they're scrolling for...
Even as adults, you're like, oh, I should have gone to bed like 4 hours ago. Why am I still on my phone?
That's right.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it's, you know, last kind of general point on education before we get back into your personal story. It's funny when you say it's a personal choice, what fits the kids best, whether it's boarding school, college, etc. Because my personal thing, I grew up in England. So I went to a general elementary school until, like, I was 11 years old. Then I went to a private all-boy high school from 11 to 16. You do your 9 exams then, and you do A-levels for 2 years when I reverted back to a public. And I've always wondered, you know, did it really benefit me being in the private, etc.? And I think so. I think it maybe set my expectations higher. I felt a sense of responsibility, but I don't really know. You know, I'm a strong believer of, you know, you can achieve anything from anywhere. There's always stories of people who didn't even finish high school, right? And my daughter, she's been in a private school since 3rd grade. But then my son, who's 9, he's in a public Montessori school. So, you know, he may come back to me in years and say, you spent X amount on my sister and not me. I'm just like, I didn't feel like a right fit for you. I mean, so, but I think I'm not that normal. I think most families do the same for their kids, so the kids have the same. Do you think that matters, or is my son going to feel he got neglected?
Oh, I think the general concept of and I do this with my own children, of what I do for one, I do for the other, just to be fair.
Right.
I don't think that necessarily means that in terms of one school being right for both children, because I've seen so many examples where children will grow through different experiences. And some of them, for example, should absolutely be on a pathway that is destined to lead them to college. What I really wish we would consider more in this country, and we're very reluctant to do because going to college is seen as a gold standard, I wish we had an equal embrace of the trade schools. You know, in other countries, there is absolutely no shame or embarrassment saying, I'm not going to college, I'm going to a trade school. And in this country, there are people who can earn significant salaries doing meaningful work and doing things they love that don't require them to go to college.
It's so interesting. So actually for me, I thought they were going to look down on me because I wanted to go to university. I went to university for 1 year. I failed the class. I hated it. I was like, you know what? It's time to go to college. And like, that was a much better fit for me. So I think that everybody's to look at different situations and like figure out like, if, I mean, just because you go to university doesn't mean you're going to make X amount of money. If you go to a trade school, you can make even more. You just never know. It's got to be the right fit for you.
And, you know, the great thing about this is another, with technology changing, the opportunities to career success, personal fulfillment are much broader than they ever were before.
Yeah.
You know, you see it in so many ways. That I think it's great because something out there is going to appeal to somebody and create opportunities they just never had before.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess one more question on the college is, you know, I came to America and I did my college in England and I had it was basically as good as free there. So I had no real student debt. And the thought of people leaving college, it was scary in a way. Well, I had the youthful optimism, so it wasn't that scary that I can find a job, I can find a career. But if I had that with $100,000 in debt, I mean, I find that depressing to think of.
People are still paying off their debt now, and they haven't been in school in 50 years.
Yeah, I mean, what would you say to someone? Do you say take student loans or do what you can to come out college debt-free?
Yeah.
I personally agree. Anything one can do to limit or not have debt is important.
At Regal Payments, we help businesses accept payments in the most cost-effective and efficient ways possible. Call Regal to find out how we can help your business not only save costs, but streamline accepting payments from your customers. RegalPayments.com. Now, you didn't always start off as a head teacher. At the Stevenson School in Pebble Beach, California, you were director of admission from 1999 to 2012. That's not a cheap school. I've looked it up. but it's your job to recruit and get people to submit admissions, or was it to vet admissions? What was your main role there?
Fortunately, both at Stevenson and Lawrenceville, my job was to manage the school's enrollment.
Okay.
And that meant essentially creating a lot of recruitment events, managing a financial aid budget, ensuring that students and their families had good experiences so that more would want to come. Fortunately, in both cases at both those schools, we had more applicants than we had places for. So if we worked hard, we could be sure that our enrollment was going to be full, especially at Lawrenceville, where it was a highly competitive school. But the truth of the matter is, the way I looked at it is, my job as the admission director or director of enrollment management, whatever the title might have been at the time, my job was to go out and tell families about the school in such a way that they could perceive an experience which in fact turned out to be reality when they arrived in September. If there was a gap between what I told them and what they experienced, that really wasn't truthful marketing.
Right.
So just to make opportunities available for kids was remarkable. And yes, we had many, many families who had the resources to pay the full tuition. At the same time, we believe strongly in access to education. So we gave away millions and millions of dollars of financial aid.
That's amazing.
I gave one example. My favorite trip every year was I would come to Chicago and I would spend the day interviewing students who were part of what's called the Daniel Murphy Scholarship Fund. And these were some very, very talented kids from Chicago who came from admittedly very modest backgrounds, but somebody saw something in them. And every year I knew I was going to be able to provide at least two of these kids with a full scholarship. And now, 30, 40 years later, they're my friends on Facebook, and it's one of those, oh, man.
Yeah, that must be great.
Yeah.
So, yes, you were there. Then you moved to, as you mentioned, Lawrence School in New Jersey in the same role. And then, but from there, you moved to Mississippi to become head of school.
Yeah.
Why the change, and had you always wanted to be a head of school? And it's important to differentiate as well. Head of school is head of all the schools. You're not a head teacher. You don't teach a class, correct?
Right. I could if I wanted to. And in fact, the term, which is now antiquated, the term headmaster, which was the most common term in schools, was meant to be that, the lead teacher. masters or teachers. Now, in today's day and age, the word master has some negative connotations, mm-hmm. and so understandably it's evolved into being head of school. But I, having watched my father be head of school, I got a sense, hey, this is a pretty hard job, many levels. At the same time, I was lucky enough in my career in admission and enrollment to tangentially get involved in things like fundraising, campus master planning, working with the Board of Trustees, working with the educators to understand their needs and wants. And then I realized, you know what, if given the opportunity, I'm going to give this a shot. And fortunately, the folks at St. Andrews in Mississippi did just that. And I'll never forget, especially my first board chair there. His name's Robbie Rogers, just one of the most amazing guys, saying, you know, thanks, Robbie, for giving me the shot.
Yeah. I know, as you mentioned earlier, you got presented a great project in at the Chadwick School. But did you feel, you know, you had more to do at Mississippi? Was it a tough one to leave, even though it was a good opportunity to come to California again?
All schools have their challenges.
Sure.
They may come in different shapes and forms and styles. None of them are easy. No day is easy in the world of education. But my job as the head of school is to understand what those challenges are. And sometimes those opportunities, like, for example, getting to Chadwick, an amazing school, one of the leading schools in Los Angeles, 865 amazing kids. We actually have a sister campus in Korea called Chadwick International and are in the process of potentially opening more campuses around the world. It's a very interesting operation. Just to be able to be a part of that community and to spend 2 years trying to help everybody remember why they love the school so much and remember why they have invested so much in the school and to see that pay off, that was more meaningful than, you know, building any building or raising any amount of money or creating any program. So you just got to find what the challenges are and then take your time trying your best to work through them.
Yeah. Now, as you've gone from 99 to 23, you've had worked at some amazing schools, yeah. and it seems like you've been a teacher, you've been head of admissions, and it's been, you know, a great time for you. But as we've known with all our guests, you know, life gets in the way, and there's different things, whether guests have had tragedies, personal incidents. Has there ever been a time where your personal life's been challenging that's affected your work, or you've had to really struggle to keep them separate to be able to focus on your job?
You know, every morning I wake up and I go through a routine of walking, prayer, meditation, yoga, and reflection and get myself ready for the day. And what I found is that no matter what life's challenges may be, as long as I have a system in place to manage them, it's all going to be okay. I also realize I've been pretty lucky. I have been able to experience life without a lot of the highs and lows. And that's why when I talk to my students or talk to their parents and hear some of the, and help them work through some of the really tough things people go through in life, that's where I realize, okay, that's why this work has real meaning. It is because you're exposed to things that some of them are unimaginable, some of them are extraordinarily painful. And whether they happen to you or somebody else, it's a way to help us all heal and get better.
Yeah. What time do you get up to do that routine?
I usually get up at 4.
And, oh, my God.
Well, I'm pretty diligent on the other end, too. 9 o'clock, my head is...
Nine's the bedtime?
9's the bedtime. All right. And so it's not like lack of sleep. And, you know, I failed this miserably. For example, this past weekend, I spent far too much time emailing or chatting with other senior administrators, violating my personal rule that I'll never email you or chat you in an evening or a weekend unless it's an emergency, because I want them to know no matter how hard we all work, we've got to make sure we take care of ourselves.
Yeah.
100%. That makes sense.
Yeah. So how long did it take you to get that routine going? How long have you been doing that for?
How long does the routine take? It's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, no, I'm like everybody else. I'm a work in progress, and I'm doing different things today to take care of myself and knowing more what works for me than I certainly was when I was 21. I've, you know, focused on this routine for about 15 years or so and added to it and grown in different ways. But I can I know the difference in myself when I am centered and healthy and free of stresses. I'm just much more present in the lives of my students and my teachers. And if I don't do that one morning, I really know it too. Okay, you just got to bear down today and be conscious of who you are, because there are moments of stress that come up all the time.
How is it with the teaching industry in a couple of ways? We've talked about mental health of students.
Yeah.
Do you make it very, is it a point of focus for you that you let teachers know that they can come to you if they have struggles, complain up, as it were? Because I'm sure teachers can be perceived as being underpaid and overworked, although they get the summers off, but still, it's a demanding job that, doesn't pay the most in general.
Yeah. It is extraordinarily demanding. I mean, if you want to ever watch an elementary school teacher teach a child to read, it's one of the hardest things anybody can ever do. And they are, unfortunately, underpaid. I say you can't pay teachers enough, and I hope we can continue to work on that. And in many ways, like medical professionals, like many of us for a variety of reasons, but especially, and I'm biased here, teachers went through a lot in the pandemic.
Yeah, for sure.
It's been hard. They had to, think about this. In March of 2020, on about 1 week's notice, teachers and administrators were told, completely transform everything you know about teaching and learning and do it differently.
Yeah. Oh. My best friend's a teacher, and I saw her go through the process that week, and I was like, whoa.
Yeah. I can't blame anybody for anything that might have happened during the pandemic with education. We're just trying to do the best we can. One of the things I realized, and a lot of us began to adopt, was a mindset that, okay, we should organizationally do something, be doing more for our teachers' emotional and mental health. And so, for example, when we were at Chadwick, we actually implemented a couple of great programs focused on that. Here's the challenge. There's now data coming out that says in corporate American schools, mental health programs and emotional wellness programs for employees don't work. So now we have a real dilemma. I know this. Teachers just want to teach, and they want to create environments in which their kids can learn. And I don't think that's asking too much. But there are times when society bears in on what they're doing and how they're doing it, and my job is to help them navigate those challenges.
With your experience, you get a sense, you can just kind of through some intangibles, you can see that this teacher's struggling. Maybe you need to go and initiate a conversation, or is it hard to see and you have to kind of wait for them to come to you, or do you get a pretty good sense?
Well, the first thing I do with my faculty is when we first meet, I did this both at Chadwick and at Liggett, I tell them my life story. I tell them things that are just completely transparent, challenges I've had, opportunities for growth I had. And I tell them I'm imperfect. I say I never claim professional perfection. Mm-hmm. I claim professional progress. I try to model that growth. The reason is I want them to know that even if they have a really tough day, even if inadvertently something goes wrong or they screw up, we're all human.
Mm-hmm.
And there has to be a culture of trust and vulnerability that is going to say, hey, we're in this together. That being said, when it comes to, in my case at least, evaluating teachers and helping them grow, there are many people at University of Liggett School who are much more qualified to do that than I am.
Right.
In that case, the best thing I can do is just try to create a framework for growth and then get out of the way.
Right. Yeah, when you mention you tell a life story and you say about challenges you had, being the Self-Belief podcast, one of the things we like to, establish with our guests is when was that moment where you really had to dig deep on your reserves of self-belief, maybe when things looked bleak or certain outside things were going on and you had to dig deep. What was that moment and how did you get through it?
I remember distinctly, and a lot of people can probably I remember this moment when Jennifer and I had two children, a newborn and a two-year-old. If there's anything that's going to make you stronger in life, it is successfully getting through those early years. Because there were days when we just looked at each other like, how are we going to do this? How are we going to do our jobs thoughtfully? How are we going to sleep? And I've taken a lot from those moments, and they taught me a lot. At the same time, when you're in charge of a school's enrollment, you are in charge of bringing in about somewhere between 80 and 90% of the school's revenue.
Sure.
And your goals can be set. Your the way you meet those goals or don't meet them is transparent to everybody. And you do that for 20 years, as I did, and you have a lot of moments of deep reflection and thought. And then you look around and realize everybody's rooting for you to succeed because they know that their job depends on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of weight on your shoulders.
It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, I actually found that harder on many days than being ahead of school.
Yeah. Do you think more people are coming into the teaching profession than before? Is it less? Is it about the same?
It's hard. The number of people entering the teaching profession is declining, and that's...
What do you think that is?
I think they look at the pay. I think they look at what teachers have gone through the past few years. I think that also in some ways, we were talking earlier, those people who are societal influencers out there are showing them other pathways to whether it be material or personal success. And it's just hard. I think we're going to have to really do things differently in the years ahead. Find ways to change education so that more people will come into it, more people will see it as a primary option, and that the environment in which education unfolds is more manageable for everybody.
Yeah, I would think as well. You see it maybe sensationalized a bit on the news and certainly made fun of a little bit, but you know, parents, and pandemic heightened a lot of things, and I coach sports, so sometimes parents are... too involved rather than just letting the coach and some other things. But you see some parents get up at school board meetings and say what they think shouldn't be on the curriculum. And it's not that they shouldn't have a voice, but they're not experts. You know, so
sometimes they're also a little bit too crazy. So like, yeah. How do you deal with those people?
Is that have you seen that over the past 10 years?
Yeah.
Like just parents just becoming to a level that you think's a bit crazy?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think we've all probably had our moments in the last few years that have been really tough. And I do know that parenting for millennials is different than Gen Xers or boomers. You know, I remember my own upbringing. My parents were very much like, go to the school and do whatever they tell you. And, you know, if we hear otherwise, that's going to be a challenge. And that's just not the way parents and children interact today. You know, my daughter, for example, she probably talks to my wife, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 times a week. When I went to college, it was like, you know, I'll see you at Christmas break. That's the way it's going to be. That connection is much stronger. The engagement is much stronger. We can't dismiss that. We have to harness that. We have to leverage it and find ways to work together. At the same time, we have to be clear about where the lines are drawn.
Right.
You know, we as educators, at least in the independent school world, one of the reasons we work in independent schools is because we can develop the curriculum as we want. Obviously, we're going to take feedback, and we're going to listen, and we want to explain why we do things the way we are. But it's not dictated to us by an outside force. Now, I've seen lots of examples, and I haven't been perfect during the pandemic, of when you know, parents have gotten excited about a number of things, and I get that. When that happens, though, I'm always reminded that the vast majority of times with parents in schools, we are on the same side. We are interacting in cordial, thoughtful manners. We do care about the same things. And that's when that happens, it's based on trust. And so when the trust is strong, we can do a lot of things. But trust is earned, so we as educators have to demonstrate to families that they can trust us. You know, my generation, Gen Xers generally start from a position of trust until proven otherwise. That's not true for millennials and Gen Z. They prove it to me, and then we'll get to a place of trust.
Yeah.
So I have to accept that reality.
I'm a millennial, but I'm on the end of millennials. But yeah.
Yeah. And I guess the other tricky thing in schools as well is that you want your students to be involved and have an opinion on world affairs, but when there's things such as, you know, the unfortunate Israel-Palestine conflict, and maybe some students want to display their views. How do you keep your campus neutral, as it were?
Oh, that's, you know, one of the things that happened when the pandemic broke out and tragically when George Floyd died is schools, at least independent schools, many got into this habit of issuing statements about world affairs.
Yeah.
most of us decided pretty quickly that that just wasn't a good thing to be doing.
No.
It never ended well. Yes, some people appreciated it, but others got equally agitated.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried to say, look, we want to teach and learn.
Mm-hmm.
We want to stay focused on that. We want to make sure our kids feel safe. We want to support all of our families. But that level of, the school taking its stance, I've never really been a big fan of that. I am a big fan of children thoughtfully taking a stance, thoughtfully expressing their views, doing it in a way that we can encourage dialogue instead of shouting.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience has been kids are really good at that when they have guidance and they know it's okay to do that. It's when we reach this point of conflict and talking past each other.
Now, Liggett doesn't, it's not boarding, right?
No. Okay. Always,
yeah. Yeah, I think it's more of an issue maybe in some boarding schools where some flags are held, displayed in the dorms and that sort of thing. Yeah.
I mean, it's a big problem. I mean, there's in Michigan now, there's so many Palestinian rallies. There's also Jewish rallies. So I think it just depends where you go. And like, but a lot of students now, like, they feel like they're nervous to say who they are.
Yeah, I really appreciate the fact that people have strongly held views. I think that's a great thing. We're passionate about things. They're important to us. And I also try to step back and say, what one person might be passionate about, if somebody else feels the exact opposite,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't mean one of them's wrong. It really is an opportunity for us to all to learn and understand and consider our own views.
Yeah, I think it's a kind of a great shame. And I feel like we're slightly starting getting back to where we can have conversations, but I think it's a great shame. Like, in Europe, there's a culture of you sit at a coffee shop, or especially older generation, you can chat, and you can chat politics, you can chat religion, and you can have different views, and, you know, you still leave the coffee shop as friends. You know, as I think there's been a long period where the volume of people's voices rise, they get offended mm-hmm. if you have a different view.
Exactly.
Borderlines, but yeah, I think you need to have discourse. And schools is an interesting place for that to happen. But
I mean, like, everybody should really have their own views. But I think that you have to be intelligently talk about your views. Like, you can't get up like, oh my god, this is terrible. Why is she saying that? Like, I feel like we've gotten away from that in politics in the country. Just because you don't like somebody doesn't mean you can't still chat with them. It's like they have to figure out a way to get back to where it's like, even in schools, like, this is my view. This is your view. This is your view. We can still be friends.
Yeah. I mean, my point with bringing that up is, are you teaching people to have those open, difficult conversations, whether it's debate class, general world affairs classes, or whatever subjects you have that touch on those? Is that something you're trying to encourage people to have?
One of the things I love about University Liggett School is that from the earliest stages of our education in pre-K, for example, where we use what's called the Reggio Emilia approach, all the way up through 12th grade, we're always seeking out mm-hmm. opportunities to help kids consider how they express their views, consider what it means to be surrounded by folks who may or may not have similar points of view. Consider that they're part of a larger community. You know, we're the Knights, that's our mascot. And, of course, that's a point of pride. No, at some level, we are all Knights, and we each bring something to the table.
Mm-hmm.
So if we do our job well as educators, we will constantly be creating forums, both in and out of the classroom, on the playing field, the stage, in the art studio, wherever it might be, where kids can explore, they can wonder, they can create, and they can encounter the uncomfortable and wrestle through that. They can be presented with ideas that are completely foreign to them. Hopefully discuss those with their peers, with their families.
Yeah.
But if we can all do it in a way that says we're all here together,
mm-hmm.
that seems like a pretty worthwhile undertaking.
Yeah,
I think that's great, but I think we're definitely still missing that. We got to get back to that.
Yeah.
Well, it starts from learned habits at a young age, right?
Yeah, and I think that's awesome that you're really putting a focus on that, especially at Liggett.
Yeah, and for me, this kind of work is essential in schools because schools are like any other community.
Mm-hmm.
The stronger their identity and their core set of beliefs, the stronger they'll be. So, you know, we're just going through a process right now, for example. It's really a strategic planning process, but we went all the way back to rewriting our mission statement.
Mm.
We went back to redefining and reaffirming our five core values. So our mission is why we exist, and our core values are what we believe. Without those in place, why would we think about the future?
True.
And lastly, I know you've just been in the role 10 months, and this isn't designed to be an advert for Liggett, but I know you've been a director of admissions, and in Grosse Pointe, you've got Grosse Pointe North, Grosse Pointe South, a bunch of good other schools. You know, why should people make the financial investment in a school like Liggett?
Ah, well, first and foremost, I think it is great when schools are surrounded by and interact with other schools that are exceptional, because that only raises the bar of where you want to be. The thing that brought me to Liggett, and I find most compelling, and I hope families will also, is that throughout our program, pre-K to 12, it scaffolds upward very intentionally through an entire program that is geared to instill in students a sense of wonder, a sense of curiosity, a sense of direction, a sense of interest in their surroundings, because I know this to be true. No matter where one goes in life, the more they have instilled in them, ingrained in who they are, the habits of inquiry, the habits of following passion, the habits of being interested in what is unfamiliar, the more they will be lifelong learners, the more they will find themselves presented with professional opportunities that otherwise they might have never really imagined.
Right.
And when I talk to our alums today, I spend a fair amount of time traveling the country talking to our alums. They tell me, in fact, we just did a huge survey on this, they tell me constantly when they left University Liggett School, they were prepared for the rest of their journey in ways you can't measure on a test.
That's awesome, because you don't usually find that in other places.
Yeah. It, for them, it is all part of being part of a culture which constantly stresses to them public speaking skills, engagement skills, the value of working really hard on something and seeing it to the point of completion. I'll give you one example. The culminating project at University of Liggett School is what we call the Academic Research Program. It's really a four-year program in high school that culminates with what's known as a celebration of research, in which the seniors present their research projects.
Cool. Right?
One of my seniors, a young woman named Giselle, she's just a lovely young lady, I found out yesterday that her project, which isn't even finished yet, has now been published in a professional publication focused on cancer research.
Wow.
I thought to myself, whoa, how many 18-year-olds can say that?
Yeah.
So knowing that kids like Giselle can do that when they're leaving University Liggett School leaves me pretty hopeful for the future.
Sure. And looking back on your career and life in general, what are three traits you have that you feel have stood you in good stead over the years?
First and foremost is a genuine wonder and sense of curiosity about the unfamiliar, the unknown. You know, I've spent time in countries like Kazakhstan, Saudi Arabia, traveling the country. It's never been a fearful experience for me. So anytime I encounter somebody who's new or different or unknown, I want to soak up whatever they have. So that is absolutely one. The second, and I alluded to this before, and I try to model this for my students, is the acceptance that I am imperfect as a human being, that I need to constantly grow, that I need to surround myself by people who make up for my shortcomings and complement my strengths. That is a never-ending process that I think can serve anybody well at any point in their life. And then last but not least is just love kids. I genuinely love being around kids every day. It is it's a magical experience.
It's amazing.
Sure. Well, this is the point where I'd normally wrap up the interview, but I feel because you're a head of school, a headmaster, as it were, you've run so many assemblies. Give us like a final thought as you would wrap up an assembly.
You know, I said to my seniors earlier this year, I was telling them about a speech I gave to my students at a prior school, in which I was talking about measuring success. And I wrapped up an assembly we had. Look, you're going to find many ways to measure your success in life. But let's be clear. Success is not measured by the size of your bank account, the size of your home, the number of social media followers you have. Success is really measured, I think, in very simple ways. And I said to the kids, if you wake up every day and go through your day. And at the end of the day, you can say to yourself, I made myself proud. I made my parents proud. I made my school proud. If you can say those three things in a positive light, you've done it. You've done everything you can possibly do in this world. If you realize you've come up short in one of those areas, take some time to reflect on it. And that's what I do every morning.
All right.
Amazing. Well,
thank you very much.
Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you both.
It's been great having you. Thanks, Tom.
Absolutely, Keith. Thank you. Thanks, Jordana.
Keith.
Jordana, let's get to the heart of the matter. Head of school, Tom Shepherd.
You know what? To be honest, I was kind of concerned about this episode. I was like, is this going to be super boring? But honestly, no. He was very interesting, and I love all he's in different schools and what he brings to the schools. It's very interesting.
You know, that's interesting, though, that you thought it could be boring. Is it just the fact of education or school that you thought may not be that interesting a topic?
Honestly, I wasn't sure. I think education interested, but I was kind of concerned of, like, what was he going to talk about? He was going to promote the school the whole time? Like, what was he really going to share? But no, talking to him, like, I think he provided some great things and great insights. And, like, he's definitely been doing this a long time. And, like, I love that he really wants to shape youth. And it's not really just about getting somebody in the school for the enrollment money. It's, but actually, how do you shape their perceptions? And, like, also, I love that he said that, like, hey, the senior, she's been in the research project. And, like, hey, she's actually getting published in, like, a cancer research. So it's, like, I really do think if you give the kids the right education and you give them the right things, they really can do whatever they want. But you have to have that person who's going to stand up and say, I'm going to motivate you. You can do this. Kids, a lot of kids do love school. Some people hate school. But I think people hate school less if they have somebody they can look up to and mentor.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting that you had that potential perspective. But I think when and if you have kids, you'll get more interested into the fit for them. Like, for my eldest, like, we didn't have any great plans of where she was going to go. She was going in the West Bloomfield school system to an elementary school. But by, you know, second grade, there was, you know, one teacher of the 30. We didn't love some of the things that were happening. I noticed some things when she was coming off the bus that her personality was different and it was not like her. And so that kind of prompted a search of, hey, where may be a better fit? And that's where we ended up on a private school for her. It wasn't a master plan. And then for our son, just the way Montessori delivers information was just much better for his learning than a different way of delivering information at other schools.
Exactly. I mean, I do disagree with one thing about what we said today in the podcast. I think that just because one kid does something doesn't mean your other kid has to do the same thing. Everybody learns differently. Me and my siblings, I mean, like, I actually have a learning disability, but compared to my siblings, I learn very different than them. Doesn't mean that I'm not as smart as the two of them. It just means that my brain works differently.
Yeah. Well, it was more as well with just the money.
That's expensive.
I don't want my son to guilt me later, but, you know,
if you're listening to this later in life, yeah, you should guilt your father for not setting
you. You can't put a price on everything. Just because your sister went somewhere, it doesn't matter.
Exactly.
But no, I think they're both they're both in a good fit for
exactly.
them.
Exactly. You know? I agree with you. Like, your private school was not a fit for your son, so obviously.
I'm not saying it's not, but, yeah, I'm in no rush to put him there.
Exactly.
Yeah. But, education is interesting, you know, because you want to have your kid develop to maximize. And then you've got all the social things coming in that you see and some parents get super passionate about.
Yep.
I mean, I try and trust that teachers can teach and, you know, they don't need my over input. Obviously, if there's something that I really disagree with, I may have to step in. But that really, that really hasn't happened.
But, like, you see, like, on the news and, like, TV, you're like, they have these board meetings, all these parents standing up. That's not the right curriculum. And it's like, okay, but sit back and think about this. Like, they obviously, like, if we have a head teacher here, Tom, like, we should trust them that they know what our children should be learning. I guess that's my opinion, but I also don't have kids.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, maybe rather than we should trust them, is we should be able to get to a place where we can trust them.
Oh, 100%.
So, yeah, by understanding what the curriculum is, understanding why it is, and, yeah, you know. But it's good to monitor it as a parent, but it's also good to be able to say that, you know, trust the teachers once you have a full understanding of what's going on.
100%.
And come with your discussion from a place of, let's all make this better together rather than a place of outrage, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I thought we've started this season off to a really good start. We've had some really great guests. We have more coming. And, yeah, we're excited to bring you more episodes this season.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we got some extremely good guests coming up, and we always want more engagement with the social media. Any suggestions from new guests? Like Jason, the figure skater, came through a suggestion, so feel free to email at hosts@selfbelief.podcast.com.
And last thing I want to say is that we also want to thank for season 3. Thank you for Office Evolution of being our home base and our host. And we're actually excited to have the owners on this season.
Yeah. They'll be kind of discussing the franchise vertical of, you know, how you get into a franchise, a competitive franchise industry, and how you work with your spouse.
Exactly.
And stay happy.
And I will say, out of any co-working space I've been to in Michigan, they really do have the best coffee. So we'll see you later.
All right. Have a good one.